agitated faces, open window, disordered furniture. There are eyes, however, before which the more usual scenes of present-day existence do not look very different. The eyes of the epic dramatist. To the dramatic total art work, he opposes the dramatic laboratory. He makes use in a new way of the great ancient opportunity of the theater to expose what is present. At the center of his experiment is man, present-day man, a reduced man, therefore chilled in a chilly environment. Since, however, this is the only one we have, it is in our interest to know him. He is subjected to tests, examinations. What emerges is this. Events are alterable not at their climaxes, not by virtue and resolution, but only in their strictly habitual course by reason and practice. To construct from the smallest elements of behavior what in Aristotelian dramaturgy is called action is the purpose of epic theater. It means are therefore more modest than those of traditional theater. Its aims, likewise, it is less concerned with filling the public with feelings, even seditious ones, than with alienating it in an enduring manner through thinking from the conditions in which it lives. It may be noted, by the way, that there is no better start for thinking than laughter. And in particular, convulsions of the diaphragm usually provides better opportunities for thought than that of the soul. Epic theater is lavish only in occasions for laughter. It has perhaps struck you that the train of thought that is about to be concluded presents to the writer only one demand, the demand to think, to reflect on his position in the process of production. We may depend on it. This reflection leads sooner or later for the writers, who matter, that is, for the best technicians in their subject, to observations which provide the most factual foundations for their solidarity with the proletariat. I should like to conclude by abducing a topical illustration in the form of a small extract from a journal published here, Commune. Commune circulated a questionnaire. For whom do you write? I quote from the reply of Renard Maublanc and from the comment added by Aragon. Unquestionably, says Maublanc, I write almost exclusively for a bourgeois public. Page 268. First, because I am obliged to, here Maublanc refers to his professional duties as a grammar school teacher, and second, because I have bourgeois origin and a bourgeois education and come from a bourgeois milieu, and so I'm naturally inclined to address myself to the class to which I belong, that I know and understand best. This does not mean, however, that I write in order to please or support it. On one hand, I am convinced that the proletarian revolution is necessary and desirable. On the other, that it will be the more rapid, easy, successful, and the less bloody, the weaker the opposition of the bourgeoisie. The proletariat today needs allies from the camp of the bourgeoisie, exactly as in the 18th century the bourgeoisie needed allies from the feudal camp. I wish to be among those allies. On this, Aragon comments, our comrade here touches on a state of affairs that affects a large number of present-day writers. Not all have the courage to look it in the face. Those who see their own situation as clearly as René Maublanc are few, but precisely from them more must be required. It is not enough to weaken the bourgeoisie from within. It is necessary to fight them with the proletariat. René Maublanc and many of our friends among the writers who are still hesitating are faced by the example of the Soviet Russian writers who came from the Russian bourgeoisie and nevertheless became pioneers of the building of socialism. Thus, Aragon, but how did they become pioneers? Certainly not without very bitter struggles. Extremely difficult debates. The consideration I have put before you are an attempt to draw some conclusions from these struggles. They are based on the concept to which the debate and the attitude of the Russian intellectuals owes its decisive clarification, the concept of the specialists, the solidarity of the specialists with the proletariat. Herein lies the beginning of this clarification, can only be a mediated one. The activists and the representatives of the new matter of factness could gesticulate as they pleased. They could not do away with the fact that even the proletarianization of an intellectual hardly ever make a proletarian. Why? Because the bourgeois class gave him, in the form of education, a means of production which, owing to educational privilege, makes him feel solidarity with it, and still more it with him. It was thereby entirely correct when Aragon, in another connection, declared, "The revolutionary intellectual appears first and foremost as the betrayer of his class of origin. This betrayal consists, in the case of the writer, in conduct which turns him from a supplier to the productive apparatus into an engineer who sees it as his task to adapt this apparatus to the purposes of the proletarian revolution." Page 269. This is a mediating activity, yet it frees the intellectual from the purely destructive task to which Maublanc and many of his comrades believed it necessary to confine him. Does he succeed in promoting the socialization of the intellectual means of production? Does he see ways of himself organizing the intellectual workers in the production process? Has he proposals for the umfunktionierung of the novel, the drama, the poem? The more completely he can orient his activity towards this task, the more correct will be the political tendency, and necessarily also the higher the technical quality of his work. And, on the other hand, the more exactly he is thus informed on his position in the process of production, the less it will occur to him to lay claim to spiritual qualities. The spirit that holds forth in the name of fascism must disappear. The spirit which, in opposing it, trusts in its own miraculous powers will disappear. For the revolutionary struggle is not between capitalism and spirit, but between capitalism and the proletariat.